Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Jeff Gannon on, who is the founder and runs the website of GannonOnInvesting.com. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's kind of cool because I've been a fan of your work since, it must have been since I'm like 16 years old, and it's finally cool to talk to you and have you on the show. So welcome. So tell us a little bit about, you know, a little bit about your background. Why don't we start there?
Okay, so I started investing probably I was 14 years old, something like that. My dad showed me an article that was discussing some sort of value investing book coming out and talked about Ben Graham. And so I got really interested in sort of the Ben Graham approach, I guess, although I've never been much of a quantitative value investor, more in terms of being an investor who focuses on business quality. So that's how I got started. And then pretty quickly, I got into writing a blog, online stuff when I was maybe 18, 19. And since then, most of my investing experience has been influenced by talking to people online, writing the blog, emailing with them, stuff like that.
Very cool. Now, is the blog your full-time gig, or is this sort of a side thing that you do?
It's full-time, but it's always been full-time, but there's been a lot of different ventures at times. I was an employee for Guru Focus briefly. I wrote many articles for them. I wrote a couple different newsletters, things like that, but it's always been connected most of the blog.
Okay, because your writing is fantastic, so I've always wondered. Interesting. Now, is the blogging still the same as you were doing 10 years ago, or have you evolved to write about different things?
I've evolved to write about different things. I guess the biggest thing is that I did more writing for other places just because it brought me more money, because it is the full-time thing I do. So the blog itself has changed somewhat in that I used to be more frequent about it and shorter posts, things like that. Over time, I did less of that. I think the early things I did for the blog aren't that great, but they're interesting for me to go back, look at, and see what I did. It was more typical blog at the very beginning, mm-hmm. More typical value investing blog, sort of like a lot of stock ideas, pretty short. And over time I changed more, to focus more on like writing sort of about the sorts of things that I really think about as an investor. I'm pretty concentrated, so I don't necessarily have a new idea every few days.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are some interesting, you know, just concepts, that you've been thinking about or writing about lately?
Lately I've been writing a lot about getting the most out of your, best ideas. I guess that's probably the biggest difference between me and most of the people that I talk to, is that they often have some really good ideas, but then they put, you know, 5% into it and they maybe hold it for a year or two or something, and that just isn't going to move your portfolio much. So a big thing I've been writing about lately is probably concentrating more, putting more like 20% into a stock if you can do that, and holding longer, holding for a few years so that you get, you know, the biggest bang for your buck in terms of the ideas that you have. Because a lot of people have a good 1, 2, 3 ideas, but they don't bet enough on them and don't bet long enough on them to get the results in their portfolio they should.
Right. Interesting. And I assume that's worked out well for you?
Yeah, it's worked out well for me. I mean, most of the times that I've had real problems in terms of losses, I would say, have been the times when I was the least concentrated. The two problems I've had are, in terms of looking back at my mistakes, owning too many stocks I don't know that much about, which I've done sometimes, and also just buying stuff because I had cash lying around. Those are the two big mistakes that I've made.
Interesting. So what are, let's go into that. So what are maybe one or two case studies of mistakes that you've made in the past?
Well, recently, in the fairly recent past, a big mistake I made was Weight Watchers. I actually own two stocks related to sort of health and fitness, Weight Watchers and Town Sports. Town Sports is runs gyms in like the New York City area. And I'd say that those Weight Watchers is probably my biggest ever. Yeah, it's definitely my biggest ever loss in just in dollar terms or in terms of a percentage of my portfolio in one stock. I probably lost about 50% of what I put into that stock. And the paper loss was 90 or 95% at one point, although I held the stock till it came back a lot. And I probably put 20 or 25% of my portfolio into that. So, you know, I lost 10 or 15% right there.
And then what was the, so tell us a little bit more about that. So what was, you know, what was the thesis, the thinking going into it? What was the mistake? When did you realize you had made a mistake? Tell us a little bit about your thinking behind all that.
Yeah. So Weight Watchers is like by far the best brand in dieting. It has the most effective program. The program historically has been effective because it's really similar to like Alcoholics Anonymous, but for overeaters. It's a real community-based thing. Almost all of the people who use it are women, and it's just very effective in getting them to continue to stick on a diet for longer than on any other plan. And so they really do lose weight. They come back to the lot. I knew all those things. I had the scale and the advertising that gave it the best competitive position, and that's the most important thing to me. So I knew all that. However, the problem is, dieting is a really, really bad business for an investor to get involved in because it's like the opposite of something like the cigarette business or something like that, where there's, as soon as someone can stop doing it, they do stop doing it. If they have any excuse to stop. So even Weight Watchers, which has like one of the lowest attrition rates in the industry, on average, you're losing all, like basically your customers aren't staying with you for more than 9 months. They almost always quit before then. So what that means is you have to get a whole new batch every year through a really aggressive marketing to get new signups. And Weight Watchers didn't do a great job with their advertising in that particular year after I bought it or as I was buying it. And they also had a really big problem with, so they already had an online thing that was going well, Weight Watchers Online, but they had a really big problem in that app started to take off in a big way. And there were things like MyFitnessPal and some other stuff that happened at the same time that got all the people interested in trying out those things and people who would otherwise try Weight Watchers. And so they had this big drop in new signups. And because your customers quit so quickly, your existing customers, if you sign up 15% less people this year than you did last year, that quickly turns into much lower profits. And they have a ton of operating leverage. And the problem for me investing in Weight Watchers was the company also had a ton of financial leverage because they would take on debt and buy back stock all the time, which is something I like to buy back stock to see the company doing that. But this caused a real problem and I considered a big mistake, especially because if, like I said, the stock was down 90, 95% at some point probably. And honestly, if credit conditions had been tighter, the company wouldn't have survived. Like if it had, if that had happened in 2008 type environment, the company wouldn't have been okay. And I knew going into it that the financial leverage is really severe. But, you know, historically it had been a very, very consistent, company and would have been fine carrying something like 5x, EBITDA in debt, which is probably what they had or close. They might have had a little less than that, but they quickly got over that number when I invested in them. And, so it was just aggressively managed that way. And the customer retention, I mean, to me, that was a really big mistake, is not considering just how bad the customer retention rate was and how serious that is to a business that you need to be able to retain almost all your customers from year to year to be a good business.
Yeah. So now, since, you know, MyFitnessPal has been out, there's other fitness apps, has the business more, I guess you could say, stabilized to some kind of predictable?
Yeah, Weight Watchers has stabilized big time. I mean, it got an investment from Oprah. She now owns, I don't know the exact amount that she, Oprah Winfrey, she owns a fair amount of this. She's on the board and I don't know if it's 10, 15% she owns now. She bought both stock and options at a good price too. So she's probably made a lot of money off Weight Watchers and she's appearing in all their ads and stuff now. Yeah, it's come back. And the, what I kind of expected to happen is that a lot of people just install something like MyFitnessPal, put, you know, download onto their phone and then never use it. Like most people, it's a matter of days and then they don't use it. Yeah. So a huge reason for that is that it free things. I mean, honestly, free diet things don't work because people just figure I haven't really, put any, you're not putting any commitment into it. I mean, right. The huge thing is you've got to commit to it. And so honestly, if you have the same program and you charge $5 a month for some app or something, or you charge nothing, the people signing for the $5 one will actually lose more weight because they'll feel they've already committed to it and they got to get their money's worth, you know?
That makes sense.
So Weight Watchers has come back in a big way. I mean, it got to a point when the stock was really cheap where I couldn't sell it, even though I'd known I made a mistake because it was absurdly cheap. I mean, it was priced, I don't know if it ever got into $4. It might have gotten down to $4 or $5. But at that price, you have to be assuming a very, not just that bankruptcy is probable, but that's highly, highly probable. I mean, I couldn't come up with any backing out any probabilities that were not close to 80, 90% that would make sense for the stock to be that cheap. So I'm not saying it's a bad stock now. I'm saying I made a mistake in it. It's obviously half the price of when I bought it. It's incredibly leveraged, though, so even now. So the issue is it could be a good bet now for people, but it's a very leveraged bet and totally different than when I was looking at it.
Interesting. So, and I do get that because I have been twice in that position where I've lost a lot of money on an investment where I made an initial mistake from the beginning, but then the thing got so cheap I didn't really want to sell it either. Mm-hmm. So I get that. Now let's talk about, you said you have a very concentrated portfolio now. How many stocks do you own?
At this moment I own 3 stocks.
Okay.
I have a lot of cash, but I own 3 stocks. Yeah.
All right. And what's approximately, what are the weightings on those investments?
I'd say, well, the biggest one is Frost, which is a bank in Texas. And I'd say it's like 35% maybe.
Okay.
The second biggest position is BWX Technologies, which is formerly Babcock & Wilcox. I got it as part of a spinoff that I bought into. And it's probably about 20%. And then there's a really insignificant position, which is a leftover Japanese net-net. I had bought a basket of net-nets in Japan several years ago. And I put probably 50% of my portfolio into about 10 of them. And I just never sold one of them because I put out, tried to sell it, didn't get the price I wanted, and just held on to it because it never rose back to the price I was intending to sell it at. So it's really just 2 stocks are close to 60% of my portfolio, I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you mind talking about those?
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, great. So let's talk about Frost first.
Sure. So Frost is the biggest bank in Texas that's headquartered in Texas. The thing that appealed to me most about Frost probably is that it's one of the most interest rate sensitive banks in the United States, probably, because it has 2 really interesting features. One, it has by far the most deposits per branch of any like branch with a significant amount of deposits. There are a few banks that have more deposits per branch, but they're usually banks with almost no branches. So Frost is an actual bank run along the lines of like a Wells Fargo or something, but it has close to probably $200 million per branch in deposits. A typical bank would have maybe 50. That just has great economics at the branch level. And then the really impressive thing about it is that it pays very close to no interest to its customers, and yet they stay with them. Most banks rely on a lot of funding that isn't from their customers or that is like CDs and other things that are very interest rate sensitive. Frost is really heavily just checking and savings accounts from the bank's own customers. And the bank's own customers are about an even split between households and businesses in Texas. It doesn't do any business outside of Texas. So I'd say probably 90% of the bank is funded with what I consider really sticky float that just isn't going to go anywhere and that they pay almost no interest on. So the bank's earnings weren't that great looking because over the last 7 or 8 years, the bank had doubled its deposits or a little more than doubled its deposits, but earnings hadn't gone up at all because the Fed funds rate went down to like nothing. So they were paying close to nothing, both in good times and bad times on their deposits. But then when they would go out and loan the money or they buy securities, they do about even amounts of both. They were suddenly getting really low yields. And so this made it really attractive if I thought that the Fed funds rate would go up. And basically, the bank was worth, I bought the bank in a way that, like, it was priced at maybe 14 times earnings or something if the Fed funds rate stayed at 0 forever. Okay. But if the Fed funds rate once went to 3 or something like that, then you had a really, really good bank. So that was my favorite position by far. And but the stock has probably gone up, I don't know, 50% in the last year, but it's still maybe 3/4 of what I think it's worth.
Okay. Interesting. And then tell us about BWX Technologies.
Okay, so BWX Technologies is basically the business is essentially just the supplier to the U.S. Navy's nuclear reactors. for submarines and carriers, aircraft carriers. So the U.S. Navy is basically a nuclear-powered navy. It has submarines and aircraft carriers. Subs are both attack subs and ballistic missile subs and aircraft carriers that are all powered by nuclear reactors. And Babcock and Wilcox has always provided those, going back to when those ships were first built 50, 60 years ago. And it's basically like a monopsony situation in the sense that realistically, Babcock is the only company that can build those reactors for them, I'd say. And the Navy is realistically, the U.S. Navy is realistically the only customer in the world who can buy enough of this stuff to keep the company in business, constantly producing it. They only produce...
Explain this to me. Why would they be the only company that can make those?
Oh, because why would they be the only... Well, because of the experience that they have doing it. I would say that probably... I might be wrong about this, but I think that for what I would consider critical components for a nuclear reactor on board a ship, the Navy is buying basically everything from Babcock, except there might be one part that Curtis Wright provides. Okay. But over time, Babcock's bought up or does every other piece of the project. Other parts are concentrated too. Like the companies that are building these ships, like the subs, I think are just General Dynamics and Huntington Ingalls. Okay. But the economics of a duopoly like that are different from a monopoly. And I also just think the nuclear reactor part of it is a better business than, actually doing the shipbuilding. So, it's very predictable that way. The business in terms of the Navy usually has like a 30-year plan or something for these sorts of projects. And Babcock can usually predict out 5 or 10 years. They do orders for these ships. They'll usually build like, 10 years a run of them at once. It's fairly easy to predict. I mean, it's incredibly easy to predict what they'll make, especially because these contracts don't involve bidding on price. Babcock has like an incentive to provide at a slightly lower cost than it otherwise would. So the operating margin improves when they do it cheaper. There's not really rivalry between the Navy and Babcock. I feel like they work together in a way that maximizes profits for Babcock while also getting the Navy of more ships than they otherwise would have usually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just think it's very attractive that way. And Frost would generally retain almost all its customers. It's a bank, and Frost happens to be focused on customer service more than any other bank I know of. But Babcock is in a similar situation that I just feel the Navy is definitely going to continue with these projects, and they're definitely going to use Babcock to do it. And obviously, there's like concerns about nuclear reactor programs for a Navy, so that Babcock isn't realistically ever going to do this work for China or someplace like that. And defense contractors in other countries aren't going to be working with the U.S. and also with their home country. So it's also just a situation where they're limited in terms of what their future growth could be, but they are always going to be in this situation where they're basically a monopoly. They do other work too. I mean, basically everything in U.S. government needs involving nuclear, really involving nuclear in any way, Babcock does. They downblend uranium. They're involved in U.S. weapons production in a bunch of ways, and they work together with a bunch of other companies on managing like sites that were once involved in nuclear activity or are still involved in some way in it. So nuclear weapons program, any defense stuff that's related to nuclear, Babcock is definitely the one who's always been doing it, and I think will continue to always do it.
Now, how are you in terms of the valuation of this? How are you looking at that?
Well, the valuation is a bit frothy right now. It probably trades at least 25, 28 times peak earnings. I haven't checked lately what the exact price is. But, they think that so I did this as an issue of the newsletter that I used to write, and I predicted out like 5 to 10 years what I thought the earnings growth would be. It's pretty easy to predict because you're basically looking at one contract that they have. And the company's recently said that they expect at least low double-digit earnings growth for the next 3 to 5 years. And that's basically right on target with what I thought was pretty obviously what they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And like I said, they only provide a couple of these ships every few years. So it's pretty easy to see what the earnings would do that way. The thing that happened, realistically, this is a company that should be valued at like 30 times earnings or something all the time. It's as predictable and as high quality as business can get.
Right.
The issue that why the stock was cheap is that it was part of a company, Babcock & Wilcox, which included a completely different business. I mean, originally they were very similar, but a completely different business in the sense that they made boilers for mostly coal power plants. And U.S. coal was just going away over time, U.S. coal power plants. And so that was a really hated part of the business. And that stock's done very badly since the spinoff. But I just think that because that was a highly cyclical and not necessarily high quality business, it led to the stock being fairly cheap, even though it had this very high quality business in it. So I'm happy to hold Babcock until I find anything better. And I think even at 25 times earnings, it could return 10% a year or something like that for the next few years.
Interesting. Now tell us about, you were mentioning another company called Howden Joinery.
Howden Joinery. So I don't own Howden yet, but it's definitely the one that I plan to buy. I usually know what stock I'm going to probably buy for a long time before I buy it, because I am so focused. So Howden is a really interesting company in the UK. It's not that well known because it's a UK stock and because it doesn't, sell to the public. It sells to builders, basically people who renovate kitchens. But what it does is it has these little, depots all around the UK, probably 600 of them right now. That sell all the things you would need to install into a kitchen. So cabinets and things like that, but also they have private label ovens and things like that they've added to the whole, inventory that they have there at these little, depots. And, they have really high customer retention because once they get one of these builders going with them, they tend to be pretty much their supplier. They extend them credit ahead of time and then, as soon as the job's done, the builder pays them back. It's a really interesting business because I just think it has a really clear future for the next maybe 5 years in that they have about 600 some depots now. They plan to get to 800. They have a very long history of same store sales growth. And I just think that they're definitely going to open about 4% more stores each year. And I really think they're going to achieve same store sales growth of probably about 4% a year. So it just seems like you're going to get an increase in the stock price of at least 8%. Historically, they've always increased their operating margin. Now with Brexit, I don't know if that's realistic, but it's just a company that I think has a perfectly predictable growth path. But unfortunately, it's only for about the next 5 years because they really are close to filling up all of the UK with these stores. At some point, there's just going to be a Howden within 5 minute drive of every builder in the country.
Interesting. Huh. Are there any other companies that? Well, actually, before I ask you this, what has you not buying it right now? You have all this cash.
Yeah, I don't know. There's not a real reason why I haven't bought it yet. I just take some time to do it. I mean, one thing is I'm thinking about the position size. I've thought about whether putting all the cash. You're probably at 30%, 35% of the portfolio in cash. I thought about whether I want to buy as much as that to put all of that into it or to take more of just a 20% position. The reason for doing that, Frost, I hesitated on for a long time because I couldn't decide whether I wanted a 20% position or a 40% position. I took the smaller position, but the stock went up, so it's close to the larger position now. But the deal with Howden is I don't necessarily want to be too concentrated because when the next opportunity comes around, I don't like having to sell Frost or Babcock or Howden. So I always hesitate a little whether I want to leave some cash there. So I guess the real hesitation is whether I'll make it about a 20% or 30% type position size.
Okay.
Yeah. I knew the company well for a long time, but it wasn't until Brexit that the stock got somewhat cheap enough, but especially the move in the pound made it attractive for me as an American investor to be able to buy this company. I had never done it in the past because the pound was, in my view, overvalued against the dollar until Brexit happened. So I generally wouldn't invest in UK stocks because I don't hedge currencies.
Okay.
So I can't invest in, unless I'm going to hedge a currency, I really can't invest in a company that is in an overvalued, in a country with an overvalued currency. And to me, the pound was definitely overvalued. So I couldn't do that.
Gotcha. Now you're launching a new website, right? Called Focus mm-hmm. Compounding.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that'll be a members only site that will be focused on sort of more concentrated investors and longer term investors. So kind of the two things I was talking about, getting the most out of your big ideas. And I hope that it has a lot of the same sorts of things that I put in the blog, but it's also going to be informational stuff. So a lot of things about accounting, case studies, things like that. But really just focused on stock picking, just a community of stock pickers and helping them pick stuff out. It's not necessarily a real value bias, I'd say. Like I said, I'm not really a Ben Graham quantitative value sort of guy.
Right.
So, you know, like even the PEs on Frost and Babcock now are probably not that low. But it'll be focused more on trying to find stocks that you can hold for a while and get a lot out of one big idea that way, especially regardless of what the stock market does. I really want it to be a site that's all about picking stocks and not a site that cares at all about talking about the market or interest rates or anything like that.
You know what? You know, it's very interesting you say that, because I remember, you know, I started my value investing career in 05, early 05. And back then it was very, it almost made you look bad if you talked about anything that had to do with macroeconomics. And mm-hmm. I have found since we've been in this low interest rate environment, you're starting to see macro theses start creeping in onto some of these value sites and saying, well, you know, if interest rates are this low, you know, mm-hmm. maybe the market's kind of expensive, and they start using these different ratios. And I've never seen that before in that much depth as I ever in my lifetime, at least. I don't know if you've mm-hmm. noticed something similar.
Yeah, I've noticed exactly that. I mean, I would say, I guess because you've had a bull market going for a while that people have to start talking that way about justifying some of the things. You know, but even value investors talking about macro things like that. I mean, to me, I tend to think in totally normalized terms. So like, I do think about macro in the sense of not making a mistake of being fooled into buying, like for instance, I looked at some things that had to do with oil.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were cheap at times. This would be going back to whenever the high was. So 3 or 4 years ago, I guess. I don't know the exact date. But both at oil companies and things, some of them that looked cheap. But also I was really interested in things like cruise lines and airlines because I thought that some of them had some real earning power that was being disguised either by actually having to pay for these things or hedging that they were doing and stuff. And I had no idea of whether I wanted to be long or short oil or whatever, but I would look at it and think that oil should be about $30 to $70 a barrel. And I thought that when oil was actually $30 to $70 a barrel, and I thought it was probably $100 a barrel. So having an idea of what the normal range is for something like interest rate. I mean, when I talk about Frost, I think my thesis basically boiled down to 3% Fed funds rate is pretty normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 5 years from now, we'll probably be around there. I have no opinion about what it'll be in the next year or something. And in the case of Frost, that was early by a year. The stock did nothing for a whole year when I owned it because if I had to guess when the Fed would raise rates, I probably would have guessed wrong and said sooner rather than later. But it made no difference to the stock. You know, after 3 or 4 or 5 years, it doesn't matter what time happened.
Yeah. And where did you get the 3% number from, out of curiosity?
I just historically, that's been a number that is likely. And, I would also say, if you're going to have some inflation, which maybe you won't, but they do target inflation. So, if you're going to have some inflation, because they're afraid of, actual deflation, then any sort of real interest rate is going to get you to have it at about 3%. Because otherwise you're going to be in a situation where your interest rates are really close to zero. So I just think that historically that's been true. I also just think if you look at how much people can earn on assets in the U.S. to not have productive assets like what businesses are doing,
mm-hmm.
To let people borrow at rates that are as low as what we have now is eventually going to either lead. I mean, eventually, if that continues to happen, you're going to have really low returns on assets. I mean, eventually your returns on assets have to move down towards your interest rates, or your interest rates have to move up towards your ROAs. There's really no way to have that,
right?
Not yeah. So, I mean, there are other countries that I think can have interest rates close to zero, but there are countries that have very bad returns on assets, so it's possible. You know, if you look at Japan or you look at certain businesses in China and stuff, yeah, they could have that. But to have, like, corporations borrow the kind of rates they're borrowing at now, doesn't make sense unless there's no opportunities for investment. And lately, I guess that's been the case, that companies just have no ability to invest marginally to make a good return. But at some point that has to change, and, you know, you have to have higher interest rates.
Right. Interesting. Now, tell us a little bit about maybe some past case studies. Some, you know, you've written a lot about a lot of companies over the years. What are maybe one or two interesting companies that you've written about that have worked out, and maybe a good learning lesson for people around that case study?
Sure. So, like, I guess a really good example, because we were just talking about macro-type things, is that after the 2008 crisis, some stocks got really cheap in early 2009. Two stocks that I bought around that time, it would have been 2009, maybe somewhat into 2010, were Omnicom and FICO, which are two of the best businesses around that I can think of. FICO obviously does the FICO score and is basically a monopoly in that. And Omnicom is probably the best advertising agency, holding company in the world. It owns a bunch of different ad agencies that you'd know the names of. They were both really cheap because obviously, no one wanted to run credit scores in 2009, mm-hmm. and no one wanted to advertise in 2009. But you knew that, you know, 5 years down the road or whatever, they'd have the same competitive position and people would have credit scores again, and they'd have, they'd be advertising again. Well, I bought both stocks, and they did well. They did very well within a year or so, and I probably sold them close to that quickly. And the returns would have been, I don't know the exact numbers, but they would have been excellent, 40 or 50% return in a short period of time. But if you look at what the stocks have done since then, since I bought them and what would have happened if I just held them, you can see I didn't really add much value by selling those things and buying other stuff after that. My initial look at them was what happens if I own them for 5 years or so. And honestly, I would have been better off holding them for 5 years or so. And some of that is the value investor in me thinking that once you get a stock that's 16, 17, 18 times earnings, you sell it, even though these are really good companies and I probably should have held on longer, knowing that they would, you know, that if the market multiple expanded, they would expand with it and they'd always be sort of priced as premium type, stocks. And so I would have done fine holding on to those things instead of kind of searching for cheaper things that are lower quality.
Right.
Yeah, because those are two of the highest quality things you can find. That was something that was different in 2008, 2009 from today. What was really exciting about that time period is I was able to buy the highest quality companies in the world. And normally, because I do have a bit of a value investing bias, when I find the highest companies in the world, the highest quality companies in the world, in normal times, they're just too expensive.
Yep.
You know, I'm not going to spend, I'm not going to pay 30 and 40 times earnings for something, even though I know it has a great 15-year future or whatever. And briefly, after that crisis, you had this chance to pay a normal type PE. You could pay 10 and 15 times earnings for stocks that, for companies that were, that you knew exactly what they were going to look like 5 or 10 years down the road.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was an exciting time that way. And I'm glad I concentrated as much as I did at that time, because going into the crisis, I had been, because things were so expensive, I had found it harder and harder to find stocks I liked. And what I did was I was buying smaller and smaller pieces of more and more stocks. Like I was saying, I was probably as diversified, as least concentrated as I had been in a long time going into that crisis. But I sold a lot of stuff and bought really concentrated on the stocks that I liked best coming out of that. And that was really a successful time for me.
Yeah. Have you ever written much about any retail companies?
Yeah. So I've been terrible as an investor in retail. This is, I'd say, by far the worst area for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've written many times about a lot of different ones, and I also bought into a stock and wrote a lot about it, which is a pretty controversial stock, which is Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
So I bought, this is going back, I guess it was 2010. Because this would have been when there was the proxy battle between the founder, Len Riggio, and Ron Burkle, who had bought, I don't know, close to 20% of the company. And so Barnes & Noble, I liked it because it was, like about all the stocks I like, it was just the dominant company in the business. And in fact, in that time, I thought it was really obvious Borders was going to be out of business soon. And Borders was probably the second place company at the time. And it did obviously go out of business. So you had this company that was just dominant. There was Amazon, and then there was Barnes & Noble, and then you knew there was going to be like nobody else in a few years. What I didn't know, so I hoped that Burkle would win the proxy fight. He came close but lost. But in addition to that, what I didn't realize is that Barnes & Noble, which I thought would have all this cash flow to basically pay back my entire investment in the company in a matter of 4 or 5 years. I mean, you were paying like, it was close to a 20% yield on the free cash flow, especially if you just looked at the retail stores. They didn't. Instead, they took basically all that money, didn't pay it. Well, they were paying a dividend originally, but they cut that. They didn't buy back stock or pay a dividend with it. What they did with it is sink it all into the Nook, which was their way of competing with the Kindle. And they lost a lot of money on the Nook, and lost it pretty quickly. It's amazing how much they burned through doing that. And so, like I was talking about what a company will look like 5 years down the road. Well, 5 years down the road for Barnes & Noble, all the free cash flow you could have had over those 5 years, they had spent trying to get into digital things and stay relevant. And of course, over those 5 years, they closed more stores. The sales of the stores had been declining, those sorts of things. So I had bought into it knowing that this was milking cash cow that was going to have problems over time. And honestly, the stores held up better than I ever thought they would. To this day, they sell more than I would have expected if I was projecting out. But the capital allocation just did not work. And so it wasn't successful to stock. I mean, I happened to sell it out at a price that basically meant no difference to me. I probably was about even on the deal, but it was taking a lot of risk for not a lot of upside, as it turned out, because I didn't realize how they would use that capital. And that's the hard thing about retailers. I think in their early stages, when they're probably not value investments, when they probably do trade at 30 times earnings, you know how they're going to allocate their capital just to expanding the chain. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably the time to buy a retailer. The time that probably is not to buy a retailer is when value investors are attracted to them. That's probably the time that you really have trouble. And this isn't unusual for me. I mean, I think if you look at like Warren Buffett, I would say his worst investments by far have been in retail. And he's made some pretty bad ones in there.
He avoids it now.
Yeah, that's what he says now, yeah. But I mean, like he bought Tesco. That was definitely him that bought it in the UK. Berkshire tied up a lot of money, well, blue chip stamps, but it became Berkshire, tied up a lot of money early on in some department stores, that it would have been much better off not investing in the 60s. And that's, the department stores in the 60s were like Barnes & Noble today. Like these were department stores in the middle of some major cities, and you just knew that, that the shopping was moving away from those things over the next 5 or 10 years, just like I knew Barnes & Noble would decline. In terms of the number of books they sold, even if their market share was solid for 5 or 10 years. So, yeah, retail is really hard business that way. I'm always looking at companies in that.
Well, you've written about Fossil too, right?
Yeah. Fossil's a really tough one. Fossil is very big in retail. It's a very interesting stock right now because it's in many ways one of the potentially best businesses in the watch area. They make most of their money off of watches.
If you ask the average person on the street, what else does Fossil make besides watches? I don't think most people could tell you.
Yeah, I mean, the business started really as a leather goods. That's where the name really originally came from. But what they did over the last few decades is get really, really big in watches, and they're really big in licensed watches. What's neat about that business is that in the U.S. at least, although when you go to a department store or someplace like that, it looks like there's all this variety of different watches you get to choose from. All the watches there have been supplied by either Movado or Fossil. They're just licensed watches that they provided under different licenses, whether you're seeing, you know, Guess or Tommy Hilfiger or whatever. That's Coach, Michael Kors. That stuff either is Fossil or it's Movado. And that whole case, that's really all that you're seeing. So they have a lot of market power, which is what I'm always interested in when looking at a company. But it is a very fashion-driven business. And Fossil in particular, more so than the other watchmakers. Fossil sells a lot to women who probably buy 4 or 5 reasonably priced watches from Fossil in a single year. Whereas some of the other companies you can look at, like Swatch, are selling, you know, a lot more to men and a lot more higher price watches that are they're being bought at, not for fashion reasons at all. So, and Fossil's been a very wild stock. But all the watchmakers have been, actually. And that's another one that people talk about, whether it's technology driven or what. I'm not sure how technology driven it is. People have had phones on them that tell the time for a long time now. So if there was going to be, because they don't need to carry a watch around, that happened, that was already the case 10, 15 years ago, that everyone had a phone on them at all times that would tell the time. So most of these watches being sold by these companies really are not because of any utility that they have that way. It's for fashion.
Yes. Yeah. I remember, during cell phones and everything like that, being younger, there were quite a few people that stopped wearing watches, just over time. So,
And the cheap watchmakers who make, the Timex and those things, the watches used to be able to get at a drugstore and stuff. There used to be real businesses in that. They're all gone. They're only fashion watchmakers. Those really were destroyed by it. The cheap watches that are just for telling the time.
That's true. I have not, because I remember, I don't know, I must have been like 9 or 10 years old, and they used to have a lot of those like sports timer watches. I don't see any of that in drugstores anymore.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Just a little bit more on retail. So there are other companies, let's say with good names, such as like L Brands or GameStop. What do you think about companies like those that are still showing pretty good returns on capital, but are obviously being hit pretty hard?
I actually looked at both those companies recently.
Okay, interesting.
L Brands was suggested to me by someone who I talk stocks with a lot.
For full disclosure, too, I'm a shareholder in Buckle, so I have some attachment to the retail sector, just to put it out there.
Yeah. And I was actually in a few GameStops recently. GameStop's kind of near and dear to my heart because the first stock I ever owned was Activision, and I bought it mainly because of my interest in the video game industry and just the future that I saw for it. Mm-hmm. GameStop potentially is very interesting. It's a problem because it has a huge free cash flow yield and it's very cheap by all measures. I don't know. It might be 5x EBITDA, something like that. Now it's very cheap.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was very impressed when I went into a couple GameStops to do some scuttlebutt. It's unbelievable in terms of the knowledge that the staff there has and just how dedicated it is to what they're doing. But also, you ask a question and you get answers not just from the staff there, but from other people looking around. They know the answers, the other shoppers there. So it's a real community thing in a way that a lot of places aren't. It's a real specialty thing that could have future that way. The problem is, I'm just worried that, their whole business is really that they get people coming back in because of pre-owned games. They trade in games and get games back from them. So they have this network effect from that. And if everything goes digital, in terms of people just downloading games directly for PlayStation, Xbox, et cetera, right from the Xbox Live or whatever they're using, then that whole entire need to trade in games and stuff goes away. And their business is entirely dependent on that. GameStop is really similar to the situation that Barnes & Noble was in 2010. So it depends.
That's what made me think about all this, is you're talking about it's Barnes & Noble, but I'm thinking about all these other companies that could look similar. Well, what about L Brands while we're at it?
Well, L Brands is really interesting because of who controls it and what they've done. Their capital allocation has been amazing. If you look at the entire history of the company over whatever, it's been 40 years or whatever, they've actually, the chains that they have now that are their biggest are not what they were in the past. They've just, of any retailer that I can think of, they have the best capital allocation over their entire history. The hard thing is, though, like I said, I've been in some GameStops. I've been in a lot of malls recently looking around, and there are just way too many stores. Especially retail and stuff I was talking about market power, about sort of the idea of, I look for companies that I know have really strong competitive position and that aren't going to be harmed a lot by actions that their rivals take. Well, when you go into a mall, you see that there are rivals literally 10 feet to the left of you, 10 feet to the right of you that other people can pick from. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing with like L Brands is a good example of that, because there's a lot of stuff in the same mall that's trying to compete with that. Now, the brand is a little different, but the sort of alternative to that product you're seeing in a lot of other places. And that's sort of the thing that scares me about retail. People say that it's because of online, which might be possible. I mean, I do most all my.
There's definitely I mean, there's definitely a huge chunk of market share that's being taken away from Amazon.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, I mean, if you look at the best malls, sort of A and B malls, they still look great, and there's a reason for people to be going them. But if you look at how many of these companies have put stores into lesser malls, that really worries me, because there's no need for those stores. These companies have their own websites. There's no need for a good chunk of the malls that exist in this country right now don't need to be there.
I think the dilemma that people look at is they say, okay, we understand, you know, a lot of this industry is in decline, but if you look at L Brands from just a pure metrics standpoint, right, it looks insanely cheap.
Yep. Yeah.
And I don't know the answer.
Yeah. And some of these, I mean, L Brands is a good example. Like, if you look up on the metrics too, in terms of, you don't see clear hints about the idea that there are problems with this business is deteriorating, really. I mean, in terms of predictability of what it looks like in terms of the returns on capital, if you covered up the name of what you were looking at, you would say this is a high quality business that deserves a high multiple.
Yeah.
But, you know, the bad news is that I have invested in some retailers, and they tend to look really good until they are losing money in, like, 2 years.
Yeah.
It doesn't take them a long time to, especially retail, it doesn't take them a long time to deteriorate really badly.
And you could, you know, so being a shareholder in Buckle, right, it's like every month it's like, well, 20% sales decline from last year, and you had that the year before. Have you looked at Buckle by any chance?
I have not, no. Okay.
Another interesting company, historically high returns on capital. I'm not going to pick stock, though, on when I'm interviewing you. But I thought if you had a perspective, it'd be interesting to hear about. Any other sectors or specific companies that you've been looking at recently that just seem interesting? Or
yeah, so one of my favorites is MRO distributors. I would say so this is usually, the acronym is usually explained as maintenance, repair, and overhaul. So this is companies like Grainger, which provide MSC, Industrial Direct, companies like that, that do basically provide all the things that a business needs that are the kinds of things that they buy one-off whenever they need to replace things and stuff like that. So it's sort of things that aren't directly related to what the business is doing, but they need it because every business needs them. And it can be, you know, everything from lighting and cleaning supplies and HVAC stuff and things like that. And I just think that looking at, there's not that many companies that industries you can look at where you have this really, you know what it's going to look like in 15 years. Will it be better or worse? All of these companies are going to be better off in 15 years. Yeah. Every customer they have, they're probably still going to have in 15 years, and they're going to be buying a lot more from them. Because what they've done is all these customers that they have, you know, once had 70 different suppliers, eventually that's going to get down to one that they want to deal with. Right. And technology is a huge part of that. These companies have invested in distribution centers, the information that they do in terms of IT stuff that they do, that they can put things together in one order, and you can have just one employee on the other side receiving all this stuff when you used to have a whole department dedicated to these things. I just think they have the most amazing, least predictable future. They're not all that cheap, but, you know, I talked about, you know, advertising agencies. Advertising agencies tend to be priced with an understanding that they're going to keep all of their customers. The business is going to be really highly free cash flow generative and all that. That's not always been the case with MROs. They're a little cyclical, at least the stocks are cyclical. So whenever you get the scare of slowdown in business activity, you can get really low prices in the stock. I think that's one area that value investors don't talk a lot about that is really easy to predict what the future will be, and they're not priced the way that, you know, certain online things and stuff where people know it's going to go online. Those things are often priced really high. Here's something that the businesses don't seem like they benefit that much from online and from, you know, these developments in technology.
Right.
But they definitely are going to benefit from it. And so that's an industry that I think is, I would definitely encourage people to look at the top 3, 4, or 5 names of whatever they can find in the industry and really learn about that industry. Because if those stocks do dip at some point, they're very attractive to buy.
What is your process for researching? Like, so for instance, how did you find Frost as an example?
Good question. I mean, it's amazing how much I usually know about the company, that it exists, a little bit about it, and haven't really looked at it. Frost for a very long time didn't look at because of the bank. I was worried about looking at banks and whether I could understand them well enough. I eventually looked at a bunch of different regional banks. I knew Frost was in many ways the strongest bank in Texas. I knew Texas has more attractive demographics than the rest of the country in the sense that it'll grow probably 1% faster. If the state has less debt, the businesses have less debt, the people have less debt. So, and it's a lower cost of living than the rest of the country. So it's just, they talk about like convergence in the Eurozone, which did not converge. There will be convergence in the U.S. in the sense that, you know, down the road, the economy of Texas will look more like the economies of California and you know, New York and places like that. So it was really, if I was going to pick a bank, it was probably going to be Frost, but I was really hesitant to look at a bank to, in terms of how well I could understand it. And even something like Frost, there are some tricky parts. I had to figure out that it was fine that they had big exposure to energy loans. That was a concern. They're one of the biggest energy lenders, meaning they were lending for people drilling wells and things like that. And I also had to be comfortable with when interest rates rise, their bond portfolio will decline a lot in value. So I had to do a little research on making sure that wouldn't impact their capital requirements. And they're exempt from that because they're not a giant bank. So that was a problem with all the banks, is that if you look at them, it's an even bigger problem with insurers. They often hold bonds that are way too long, and that will decline a lot in value as interest rates rise. And I don't know that people pay enough attention to. It's just a one-time loss for someplace like Frost, and it's more than offset by their future earnings. But worrying about things like interest rates was why I didn't look at Frost for a long time, because I'm not really into looking at macro things that way.
Right. Yeah, interesting. On your end, is there anything else that you would like to talk about while you're on the show?
No, I don't think that there's anything else. I think that's really it. Yeah.
Well, I will ask you. Well, I'll ask you two more things.
Okay, sure.
So the first thing is, you've been at this of quite a while, right? There have not been, you know, I just remember, you know, 06, 05, I guess, when I was starting. I was a value blogger myself, if you remember. Most of these guys are not at it anymore. You've been at it for quite a while, right? Most of these guys have gone away. What keeps you going? Like, what has you continue to do what you do?
It's the emails that I get from people, talking with people. That's really been the ability to share stock ideas with them and hear back from them. Pretty early on, I realized that I needed to, instead of always trying to generate what I wanted to talk about, I needed to get other people to send in basically ask questions, tell me what they want to hear. Because for one thing, you forget what you didn't know when you started out. And they let help you see things in a different way. And so the questions I got from people is really what made it. That's the only way they continue to do it, is just I got different people coming in, asking questions, connecting with me, telling me about different stocks that they know of in the countries that they're from, and keeping things exciting for me that way. I mentioned Oprah Winfrey with Weight Watchers. I had heard an interview that Oprah did where she talked about how important it was for her to do an after show thing, where she got to hear what her audience had to say, and that she started that to decide what to put on the show and everything, and that she felt that was the thing that most improved her ability to put out a good show. And I've got to say, that's definitely been true for me. If it hadn't been for all the emails that I get coming back to me, being the way that I decide what to write about, I wouldn't have kept doing it, and I don't think I would have gotten as good at it as I have.
It's very interesting. How did you, so the, you know, when I first heard of you, I think I found you through doing research and found a company called Village Supermarket, and it also happened to be the first stock I ever bought in my own account. So it was very nostalgic for me. What was your process for finding Village? I really want to know this. What was your process for finding Village Supermarket? What was your original thesis, and how have things progressed over about the decade since you've written about it?
Yeah, so I wrote about Village about a decade ago. That's probably right. And I knew about the stock from longer than that. I certainly knew about the stock around 2000, 2001. And had owned it myself for several years before I wrote about it on the blog, because I owned it long before I had the blog. I bought it as a teen. Honestly, I kind of had an inside, I had a little inside advantage on people on that one. I took a job at a ShopRite, which is what Village Supermarkets are in New Jersey. And so I was a cashier. And I just realized that this is just an amazing business in terms of what it could be capable of earning per store and how much operating leverage there was in it. And I just realized that from being a cashier. I also got the idea for Coinstar working at a Village because I saw how people use their Coinstar things, that they would go and put their money in and then they come back with this ticket that they could use in the store or ask for money. They didn't ask for money. They always used it as found money to spend on their groceries and stuff. And so they totally didn't care what commission Coinstar was taking. So I got both of those ideas, Village Supermarket and Coinstar, from working as a cashier in a ShopRite at like 14 or 15 years old and just watching customer behavior there and just seeing how, I mean, those stores do a huge volume in one location. Whenever the till would get over $2,000, I'd have to cash out. I can't tell you how many times we'd just go over 2,000 over and over again, in terms of volume I was doing there. You didn't get a moment of downtime there as a cashier. And it's just because of like the density of the population in that area. And that is where I grew up, is Northern New Jersey, which is where most of their stores are. Mostly I just realized that once these stores were successful, once they're being run the right way, and in Village's past, they had some operating problems sometimes. But by then they had turned things around, and since they were running these things efficiently, I just realized, I just realized that there's no way you could put a competing store near them. I mean, that's changed a little bit by now because I've looked at companies like the Fresh Market or something that have models where they can go in with a smaller store format. But New Jersey generally, and Northern New Jersey especially, you can't put a 60,000 square foot store anywhere in there. I know people don't realize that they don't believe that this is true. But if you've been to these places and looked around, you'll just see that you're not going to get the parking that you need. That Village never had parking. Literally, sometimes you'd go and park in, you know, the next lot over because there's just not enough parking for everyone to shop at that store. That was what limited it. And the company will even say that at times. They said that the limiting factor was parking. Whereas you go to, like, where I live now in Texas, you go to a Kroger, they like to put all four sides. They like to put parking all around it. And it's a lot easier to compete with the Kroger because you can put another store that's pretty similar to it nearby. You can't do that in New Jersey. Now, that limits Village in terms of their ability to ever move out into other parts of the country or anything like that. But, I guess the way I would explain it is that people lump all supermarkets together, but the economics of a supermarket at the store level are entirely dependent on who lives in about a 5-minute drive radius, maybe 10-minute drive radius of your location. How many other stores are there that can compete with you? And then how many households are there and how wealthy are those households? That just determines the economics of the supermarket business. And if you're in Southern California or you're in Northern New Jersey and you're happen to own these plots of land or to have 40-year leases on them for a long time, they can be a really amazing business. Whereas if you have the same supermarket run by just as confident people doing the same business model in the middle of Kansas, it's a really lousy business. And it's just because the people that are in that circle that you have, your market area is really a 10-minute drive. That determines everything. And so that was really, I guess, trying to think that two supermarkets don't have, just because they're both supermarkets, their economics don't have to be similar. That's what really got me to buy the stock once I figured that out, once I understood that these two things that people treat as the same sort of stock are not the same sort of stock at all. And the stock was only reasonably priced because, like I said, it was around 2000, a little bit after that. There had been this huge thing with big stocks people liked and tech people liked. And this is a small stock that was in a boring industry. And so actually grocery stores are pretty cheap generally, and small stocks were really cheap. And so that was the reason why that stock was available. I mean, that's been a big reason for the return in the stock. I think it was maybe 7 times earnings off and around when I first bought it. And then it's not been unusual for the stock to trade at 17 times earnings since then, you know, because it's changed in terms of how people valued it. They just went from seeing it as something that's worse than the big supermarkets to saying that it's something that's just as good.
Yeah, and then how have things progressed over the last 10 years?
Well, I mean, so the stock's done well over that time, obviously. Probably from 2000 to today, the stock's returned 12% a year, something like that. I've looked at supermarkets since then, and the industry has potentially gotten tougher. Like I said, in the one that I really worried about in Village's area is the fresh market.
Fresh markets.
Yeah. Just because that has a payback. So a Village store has a payback period that's more than 5 years. There's just a huge investment up front and everything in it. And that's just true for all the big, I mean, Village is not going to build anything less than like 60,000 square feet. And they like to build bigger than that now if they could build a new site. So these are big investments to take a long time to pay back. You're not going to suddenly have a new competitor come in a town that has two or three of these competing stores. Like they have Kings and Stop and Shop and places like that compete with them in the New Jersey area. You're not going to add a fourth store when there are three in there and you know what the returns are. And you're certainly not because of how impossibly hard it is to get a new site. It'd be years of planning to get one in there. Fresh market's not like that. You can open a fresh market in New Jersey and get a payback that's pretty quick. But fresh market really is just the specialty department. So it's produce, seafood, meat, things like that are really where they compete. And that did worry me. Anything that can get in a small format size like that does worry me. And to some extent, Amazon can be a problem for Village, not so much for all supermarkets, but it is a problem for some of those things if it starts to siphon off the more profitable parts of people's shopping trips. Because the truth is, Village gets people to come in to buy everything, but their margins are a lot better on some stuff than on other stuff. And you don't want all of the best businesses, the specialty department stuff business, to ever be shifted to someplace else. You really don't want someone to buy all their groceries at Village and then buy their seafood and their meat and everything fresh and all that stuff over the fresh market. That would be bad if people did that. And from what I could tell from talking to people, that isn't what they do. And that actually something like the fresh market is surprisingly infrequent trips that people make. There's a lot of people that go once a month. They do all their special occasions and everything there, but it hasn't replaced Village, hasn't replaced ShopRite's as the place that they go to every week, which is what matters most.
Have you looked at the supermarket industry just in general recently?
Yeah, I've looked at it a lot recently. I mean, I especially looked at, in terms of really big stock, I have looked at Kroger, because I honestly do think that Kroger is the best, it's probably the best run supermarket around. Their returns aren't anywhere near as good as Village, but it's just because their locations aren't as good places. Honestly, I think Kroger runs their supermarkets better than Village runs theirs. But Village has the best locations. And I've looked at them because you've seen deflation in food. In terms of actual prices of things in the supermarket, they've deflated more in the last year or two than at any time in at least the last 50 or 60 years. And so, which is amazing because the rest of the country generally isn't experiencing deflation, but you are seeing in grocery stores. And so what I think's happened is some people see same store sales of 0% or slightly negative, and they think this is a disaster. But if you look at them on real terms, some of these places are actually having real sales growth of 1% or 2%. They're doing perfectly fine in terms of the traffic they're getting in and what people are buying. It's just that the prices of things have gone down, but it's because the prices from that they're buying as supplies have gone down. So it's an interesting possibility to look at these stocks. Yeah.
What about the ones like, say, more of the specialty supermarkets, like a Whole Foods or something like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, Fresh Market went private. Otherwise, I would have written an issue about it. It was not a cheap stock, but I was really excited about that company as a concept. And I think they made some mistakes in terms of where they chose to locate some of their stores. They did a thing where they didn't cluster the stores, and they don't have their own distribution system. So if you don't cluster your stores, you have some severe diseconomies of scale relative to all your competitors. Like Village has their own distribution stuff. So that's a big problem. I was going to pick the Fresh Market and seriously consider investing in it until not long before it went private.
Interesting. What do you think about Whole Foods today?
Whole Foods is tricky because it's kind of in an in-between situation. It's not as general as something like Kroger or the Village, and yet it's not as specialty as I'd like to see at something like the Fresh Market. Like here in Texas, I do a lot of my shopping at Central Market, which is like a Fresh Market, except it's the size of a Whole Foods. And so, that's tough if concepts like that start competing with you. So I do worry that Whole Foods is in sort of, I guess what I worry about Whole Foods is it's in kind of the most exciting part of the, it's this big target that's in a really exciting part of the business. So other companies are going to try to compete by becoming more like Whole Foods. And that always worries me when I see that dynamic in an industry. I don't like to invest in the really sexy part of the industry where I think a lot of other companies are going to be putting their capital.
Yeah.
I was excited that Village, I didn't think anyone else would try to put a store near them. I'm not excited that I think a lot of people will look and say, is my concept as good as Whole Foods? Maybe I should pick the same zip codes and stuff that they've picked and try to go after the same sort of client base there. Yeah.
Well, you don't like when there's increased competition in your investment?
Well, amazing. All right. Awesome. Well, it's been great talking to you. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I want to ask you, is there any, you know, that focus compounding, is that something you'd like to give more information to our listeners for people interested?
Yeah, so Focus Compounding will be up sometime in the next month, probably. Like I said, it'll be a members-only site. There'll probably be some stuff up there that is free for other people to access. But then after that, I think it'll be like $50 a month or something to do it as a member. It'll be a lot more than just a blog. There'll be forums and things for Stack Ideas. It'll all be people who hopefully have the same sort of ideas about investing that you've heard me talk about here. Yeah.
And that announcement, I assume, will be on your blog?
Yeah, there'll be a lot about it on the blog, I'm sure, yeah.
All right, and then if people want to contact you with questions, is there a way to contact you through your blog, or what's
the easiest way is just to go to GannonInvesting.com, and there'll be a link right up there that just says email.
And that's Gannon with two N's, right?
Yep.
All right, great. Well, it was a pleasure having you on, Jeff.
All right, great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Have a good rest of your day.
You too.
Great, thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.